Blog Talk Radio.
Double, double, double. Double, double, double. Shoot a come Rosie, tell me to come. Said she didn't have a daughter, said she didn't have a son. She said the lift doesn't run, run up the stairs and come. And if it don't come quick, you're not gonna know that son. So I grab a bunch of rose and I started to run. Here I come, whoa. 2 months later she said come and get your son, cause I don't want your baby to come tie me down. Now because you are old and I am young, yes while I'm young, yes I wanna have some fun. Run me down, should live out of
under the pretext that you want to integrate. No, you're out of your mind. The political, the economic philosophy of black nationalism only means that we have to become involved in a program of re-education to educate our people into the importance of knowing that when you spend your dollar out of the community in which you live, the community in which you spend your money becomes richer and richer. The community out of which you take your money becomes poorer and poorer. And because these Negroes who have been misled and misguided are breaking their necks to take their money and spend it with the man is becoming richer and richer, and you're becoming poorer and poorer. And then what happens? The community in which you live becomes a slum. It becomes a ghetto. The conditions become run down. And then you have the audacity to complain about poor housing in a run-down community. Why, you run it down yourself when you take your dollar out. And you and I are in a double trap, because not only do we lose by taking our money someplace else and spending it, when we try and spend it in our own community, we're trapped because we haven't had sense enough to set up stores and control the businesses of our community. The man who's controlling the stores in our community is a man who doesn't look like we do. He's a man who doesn't even live in the community. So you and I, even when we try and spend our money in the block where we live or the area where we live, we're spending it with a man who, when the sun goes down, takes that basket full of money in another part of the town. So we're trapped, double trapped, triple trapped. Anywhere we go, we find that we're trapped. And every kind of solution that someone comes up with is just another trap. But the political and economic philosophy of black nationalism, the economic philosophy of black nationalism shows our people the importance of setting up these little stores and developing them and expanding them into larger operations. Woolworth didn't start out big like they are today. They started out with a dime store and expanded and expanded and expanded until today they're all over the country and all over the world, and they're getting some of everybody's money. Now, this, what you and I and General Motors, the same way, didn't start out like it is. It started out just a little rat race type operation, and it expanded and expanded until today it's where it is right now. And you and I have to make a start. And the best place to start is right in the community where we live. So our people not only have to be re-educated to the importance of supporting black business, but the black man himself has to be made aware of the importance of going into business. And once you and I go into business, we own and operate at least the businesses in our community, what we will be doing is developing a situation wherein we will actually be able to create employment for the people in the community. And once you can create some employment in the community where you live, it will eliminate the necessity of you and me having to act ignorantly and disgracefully boycotting and picketing some cracker someplace else trying to beg him for a job. Anytime you have to rely upon your enemy for a job, you're in bad shape. And he is your enemy. Anything. You wouldn't be in this country if some enemy hadn't kidnapped you and brought you here. On the other hand, some of you think you came here on the Mayflower. So as you can see, brothers and sisters, today, this afternoon, it's not our intention to discuss religion. We're going to forget religion. If we bring up religion, we'll be in an argument. And the best way to keep away from arguments and differences, as I said earlier, put your religion at home, in the closet. Keep it between you and your God. Because if it hasn't done anything more for you than it has, you need to forget it anyway. Whether you are a Christian or a Muslim or a nationalist, we all have the same problem. They don't hang you because you're a Baptist. They hang you because you're black. They don't attack me because I'm a Muslim. They attack me because I'm black. They attack all of us for the same reason. All of us catch hell from the same enemy. We're all in the same bag, in the same boat. We suffer political oppression, economic exploitation, and social degradation. All of them from the same enemy. The government has failed us. You can't deny that. Anytime you live in the 20th century, 1964, and you walking around here singing, "We shall overcome," the government has failed us. This is part of what's wrong with you. You do too much singing. Today it's time to stop singing and start swinging. You can't sing up on freedom, but you can swing up on some freedom. Cassius Clay can sing, but singing didn't help him to become the heavyweight champion of the world. Swinging helped him. But this government has failed us. The government itself has failed us. And the white liberals who have been posing as our friends have failed us. And once we see that all these other sources to which we've turned have failed, we stop turning to them and turn to ourselves. We need a self-help program, a do-it-yourself philosophy, a do-it-right-now philosophy, it's already too late philosophy. This is what you and I need to get with. And the only way we're going to solve our problem is with a self-help program. Before we can get a self-help program started, we have to have a self-help philosophy. Black nationalism is a self-help philosophy. What's so good about it, you can stay right in the church where you are and still take black nationalism as your philosophy. You can stay in any kind of civic organization that you belong to and still take black nationalism as your philosophy. You can be an atheist and still take black nationalism as your philosophy. This is a philosophy that eliminates the necessity for division and argument. Because if you're black, you should be thinking black. And if you're black and you're not thinking black at this late date, well, I'm sorry for you. Once you change your philosophy, you change your thought pattern. Once you change your thought pattern, you change your attitude. Once you change your attitude, it changes your behavior pattern. And then you go on into some action. As long as you got a sit-down philosophy, you'll have a sit-down thought pattern. And as long as you think that old sit-down thought, you'll be in some kind of sit-down action. They'll have you sitting in everywhere. It's not so good to refer to what you're going to do as a sit-in. Then right there, castrates you. Right there, it brings you down. What goes with it? What, think of the image of someone sitting. An old woman can sit. An old man can sit. A chump can sit. A coward can sit. Anything can sit. Well, you and I have been sitting long enough, and it's time today for us to start doing some standing and some fighting to back that up. When we look at other parts of this earth upon which we live, we find that black, brown, red, and yellow people in Africa and Asia are getting their independence. They're not getting it by singing, "We Shall Overcome." No, they're getting it through nationalism. It is nationalism that brought about the independence of the people in Asia. Every nation in Asia gained its independence through the philosophy of nationalism. Every nation on the African continent that has gotten its independence brought it about through the philosophy of nationalism. And it will take black nationalism that to bring about the freedom of 22 million Afro-Americans here in this country where we have suffered colonialism for the past 400 years. America is just as much a colonial power as England ever was. America is just as much a colonial power as France ever was. In fact, America is more so a colonial power than they, because she's a hypocritical colonial power behind it. What do you call second-class citizenship? Why, that's colonization. Second-class citizenship is nothing but 20th century slavery. How are you going to tell me you're a second-class citizen? They don't have second-class citizenship in any other government on this earth. They just have slaves and people who are free. Well, this country is a hypocrite. They try and make you think they set you free by calling you a second-class citizen. No, you're nothing but a 20th century slave. Just as it took nationalism to remove colonialism from Asia and Africa, it'll take black nationalism today to remove colonialism from the backs and the minds of 22 million Afro-Americans here in this country. And 1964 looks like it might be the year of the ballot or the bullet. Why does it look like it might be the year of the ballot or the bullet? Because Negroes have listened to the trickery and the lies and the false promises of the white man now for too long. And they're fed up. They've become disenchanted. They've become disillusioned. They've become dissatisfied. And all of this has built up frustrations in the black community that makes the black community throughout America today more explosive than all of the atomic bombs the Russians can ever invent. Whenever you got a racial powder keg sitting in your lap, you're in more trouble than if you had an atomic powder keg sitting in your lap. When a racial powder keg goes off, it doesn't care who it knocks out the way. Understand this, it's dangerous. And in 1964, this seems to be the year. Because what can the white man use now to fool us? After he put down that march on Washington, and you see all through that now, he tricked you, had you marching down to Washington. Yes, as you marching back and forth between the feet of a dead man named Lincoln and another dead man named George Washington, singing, "We Shall Overcome." He made a chump out of him. He made a fool out of him. He made you think you were going somewhere and you end up going nowhere but between Lincoln and Washington. So today our people are disillusioned. They've become disenchanted. They've become dissatisfied. And in their frustrations, they want action. And in 1964, you see this young black man, this new generation, asking for the vote, ballot or the vote. That old Uncle Tom action is outdated. The young generation don't want to hear anything about the odds are against us. What do we care about odds? When this country here was first being founded, there were 13 colonies. The whites were colonized. They were fed up with this taxation without representation. So some of them stood up and said, "Liberty or death." Though I went to a white school over here in Mason, Michigan. The white man made the mistake of letting me read his history books. He made the mistake of teaching me that Patrick Henry was a patriot. And George Washington wasn't nothing nonviolent about old Pat or George Washington. Liberty or death was what brought about the freedom of whites in this country from the English. They didn't care about the odds. Why, they faced the wrath.
Enough is enough. And you are not coming to the people's defense.
That's right, right.
So if you want us to do better, then damn it, you do better. Do what you say. This country is supposed to be about the land of the free for all. It has not been free for black people, and we are tired.
One question, protect and serve who? To me it seems that they just quit to observe you. And then they have the nerve to come and disturb you. Enforce a curfew, they physically hurt you. I heard the patience was a virtue. But how long we gonna disregard the fact is we all talk and practice. This new age, trying to rebuke rage.
We always say to Black Panther Party that they can do anything they want to us. We might not be back. I might be in jail. I might be anywhere. But when I leave, you can remember I said, with the last words on my lips, that I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am the people. I'm not the pig. You've got to make a distinction. And the people are going to have to attack the pig. The people are going to have to stand up against the pig. That's what the pastors are doing. That's what the pastors are doing all over the world.
Fred.
Black power, black power, black nation. You're tuned into In Defense of the People, weekly Tuesday night radio broadcast at 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, People's Political Party National Chair, Matt Turner, co-host, myself, Brother Motherland, National Minister of Defense, and our engineers on the ones and twos, National Minister of Communications, Sister Amina, calling each and every Tuesday night, same black place, same black time at 845-277-9266. Press 1 to participate. Tonight's topic, Bible mysticism continues. We're going to open up our phone lines to our national chairman, Ned Turner, Black Power, All Power to the People. Conrad, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. You can hear me, brother?
10-4, can hear you loud and clear. Conrad, Black Power.
Yeah, right. Black Power, All Power, right on, right on. We're going to try to wrap up, you know, the topic we've been on for the past couple of weeks. We actually would have been finished last week had not the forces that operate for the state in the media department, the telecommunications division, when they knocked out our show. But we're going to try to wrap up tonight, try to start a little earlier. I didn't want to, like I said, you know, I didn't want to just, you know, make some passing references, you know, just generalize, you know, some I heard His little brother used to play basketball for the Sacramento Kings some years ago when, you know, they had a good team, and this was when Shaq and I guess Hulk Hogan was playing for the Lakers. It was something to say, you know, Shaq was, you know, always talking in the media. And the little brother said, well, you know, Shaq's known for talking out the side of his ass. You know, so we didn't want to do that. We just wanted to go on some specificity. Again, believe that knowledge is universal. Knowledge is infinity. That knowledge belongs to the people. There have been those that have come, you know, throughout time and have hoarded it, have gotten themselves in possession of it by being the controllers, the rulers, the dominant group, and enslaving the rest of us by withholding that type of knowledge. Something also comes to mind, and I reflect back a lot, you know, when I was, you know, a teenager, more than ever now, because I just think about all the things that, you know, as an individual myself, all the things that I was told, you know, all the things that were poured into me to believe, you know, all these belief systems and these beliefs and stuff, you know. And I just realized that, like, now, understanding why and for what reason, you know, we're at the precipice now of American society that others would like to refer to as civilization. But it has been anything but civil. It has been inconsistently civil, if anything. You know, these terms that Europeans like to kick around, you know, in the intellectual world or even media, you know, using sublime language to talk about themselves, you know, white people of the planet, you know, the pale-skinned people of the planet, and refer to themselves as such sublime terms as the West, opposed to the East, or the Occidental, as opposed to the Oriental. You know, all these are terms that were created by, you know, the European, you know, leaders, think tank individuals who study history and sociology, philosophy, political science, geography, you know, geology, you know, of that nature, to maneuver the black and brown peoples of the world into a position of vulnerability, of being vulnerable. Just wanted to, like, you know, paint another picture. You know, we left off talking about the Muslim concept or the Muslim ritual about circling the Kaaba shrine seven times and why the number seven. If I was a betting man, I would bet against the average Muslim knowing why it's seven times. They may correlate that, you know, to the 7 days creation, the 7 day creation story and whatnot, you know. Some may even, you know, cite the, you know, what is referred to as the seven stars and seven planets, you know, but the number seven just didn't pop up out of the blue. It was for a reason, psychological reasons, that number had become so enshrined, ingrained in our ancestors' heads. You know, African people, whom the Greeks had referred to as Ethiopians. They have said that the Ethiopians were pretty much everywhere, with the Europeans referred to as the Middle East, the Near East, and so forth. The Greeks had said that the Ethiopians were there, you know, that they were the indigenous people. They were the ones who founded the, was now referred to as religion. They were the ones who had started the commencement of the worship of God, you know, the gods, you know. And I don't use that term loosely, gods, in an indigenous context, beyond the West or the Euro-American academic theological perspective. African people have always known the one and only true and living God is the Muslim Sikh. They know him as Allah. And in Africa, he's known under a number of names. As a matter of fact, they have trouble trying to find the origin, the etymological root for the word Allah, or which is the same as the Hebrew Eloh, E-L-O-H. Trying to find the etymological origin for it. And so they've debated, they've argued, they've gone back and forth. Even the word Al, A-L, or L, E-L, you know, they've had trouble with that. And for the longest, they have neglected to look to Africa for it and still do today. But, you know, some of us have gotten beyond the box, able to think outside the box, and we begin to look at things that they say they couldn't have a origin for. And in linguistics, in language, what they tell you is when it comes to ancient writings and inscriptions and whatnot and so forth, they you know, and they can't figure something out or unknown language, and they draw the conclusion that the language is unknown, it's not like any other language. Well, this is what they do. They tell you that it's non-Semitic and it's not Indo-European, as though those are the only two branches or families of language that exist on earth. You know, and they always include as another branch when they say Hamitic, Semitic and Indo-European. Okay. And those are biblical terms, the Hamitic and the Semitic. And as we explained, that Ham was a black man. There was a historic and living Ham. He was a black man because he, according to the table of nations, the 10th chapter of Genesis, he was a black man because he was the forefather, the progenitor of all Africa, of all the African tribes in Africa. And that Shem was the forefather of all the tribal peoples in what we know today as Asia. And this is where the word Semite comes from. In actuality, when you spell Shem, S-H-E-M, and that S-H is just one consonant letter. It's a double consonant. And so the H gets left out of pronunciation, and therefore it gets left out of later spelling, and it becomes Sem, and therefore Semite. But even the Semites were black. The Ethiopian people speak Semitic languages. So they are black Semitic-speaking people. You know, and this is the game that they play. You know, so in looking to Africa, you see this root called Olu, O-L-U. And it has a meaning for the Most High, the heavens, the sky, the above, which is sublime language for the house of God. And this is why in a lot of parts of Africa, that name, that term is in the front part of the longest pronunciation of the terms. You see what I'm saying? For the record, you know, but the indigenous people in their studies of stars, you know, began to prefigure these things in their psyche. And this is how it came about. So I wanted to go a little bit more into this ritual because all the pretty much, you know, the so-called major religions, you know, they all have this ritual. They all have the same ritual that they do. You know, I've written a lot over the years. And it took a while to get, you know, to a certain stage, a certain point of understanding, you know. But there's this, you know, this term that they use called circumambulations, you know, which is just no more than saying the word circumference. You know, circumference, and of course, you know, the first four letters and the term is the same as the word circle, you know. So they, you know, they go around a particular object or like the Muslims do, go around a building, you know. And the Hindu people have done it. The Hindu people still do it. In one instance, when the Hindus talk about, they have a ceremony, a cremation ceremony, where the family's oldest son or relative circumambulates the deceased seven times and recites a prayer to relieve their late loved one of his or her sins. You know, then the body is, you know, consumed by fire. Another instance, we have a population in a part of southern Kenya, you know, to be blessed with a child in the womb. Hindu women go seven times around a sacred fig tree, you know, a reflection of the Buddha, you know, who was the founder of the Buddhist so-called religion or Buddhist faith. And there's this legend and story that the Buddha was born underneath the fig tree. And so they go around this fig tree seven times in order to be blessed, you know, with having a child or, you know, to become pregnant. And this is psychology. You know, there's so many of them, you know, that I can, you know, try to give. But there's a story that talks about the circumambulations, you know, the purpose of the Godhead known as Priyavarata, you know, who was like one of the early forefathers of humanity, similar to like the biblical character, you know, the biblical persons, Cain and Abel, right? Dissatisfied, you know, that our planet couldn't be fully illumined all at once, he got in his heavenly chariot and followed, the sun around the earth seven times in an attempt to solve the problem. You know, these are stories, you know, that were created, legends, you know, mythological stories that have a moral character to it, you know. And of course, you know, the Buddha himself, you know, said that went around, you know, the sacred fig tree seven times before seating himself underneath it to secure what they call the Great Awakening, you know, Nirvana, you know, which is that, you know, the seventh chakra, which is the highest plane. You know, there's these books, these scrolls, these writings that the Buddha said they've written, or those who have become his followers. They wrote a number of stories. And some fascinating stories, accounts, adventures, and whatnot, travels and stuff. It's something about an episode that was referred to as the Lotus of the True Law, alludes to Mahasat, which is referred to as the Enlightened One, according to the Buddhists, right? Who visits another person of like mind, described as the king of the mountains, or in possession of a pearl necklace. He approached the place where the Lord was sitting. After humbly saluting the feet of the Lord and circumambulating him seven times from left to right, he offered him the necklace of pearls in the token of homage. Seven times. And this is, you know, in the you know, the Buddhist belief system. There's a island off of the southern end of India. Some refer to it as Ceylon. I'm going to pronounce that right. A book, you know, which speaks about a young prince named Abaya, who, you know, had been at war with his uncle. You know, is told about a white-bodied, red-footed female horse, which is actually the cloak of a beautiful celestial being who could bestow wealth or good through her magical power, right? Known to frequent this area, you know, the chief river of the island, you know, this mare, you know, I think that's a female horse, know, he attempted to capture this horse, which caused it to frighten, you know, the fleet. So seven times in her flight, you know, she circled around the pine and plunging into the Mahaganja, which is the great river, climbing forth again to the shore. She fled seven times around this mountain called the Dumaraka. Right? The prince who, you know, in his attempts, and he gets the hearts, you know, to submit and declare, I will conquer the kingdom and give it to the slave Nat, which is the horse. So the horse blessed him with the kingdom, good fortune. But the number seven, how many times? And of course, you know, the Muslims, now there's actually what Christians know is a scripture, right, of the Bible world, you know, in the Quran, it's referred to as a surah, right? That chapter, in other words. But the scriptures in the verse 29, the 22nd surah, and it says, in reference to, you know, the Muslim, you know, then let them complete the rites prescribed for them, perform their vows, and again circumambulate the ancient house. And the ancient house, of course, is sublime language for the Kaaba shrine, you know, what some believe. In a deeper sense, more sublime, a spiritual sense, you know, in Iran, of course, it was known as Persia. There was this person who was referred to as a mystic, Mansur el-Halaj, where he stated, one should circumambulate the Kaaba of the heart seven times. You know, and then there's one of their Arab historians, a writer named Ibn Arabi, explains that it is around the heart that the spiritual pilgrim circumambulates. So now they're talking about the depths of the heart, you know, which is the seat of the soul, you know, and so to speak, you know. And as I mentioned, though, the, you know, as far back as what they referred to was the 9th century, you know, 1,200 years ago, you know, they believed that the Kaaba, which is the name of the shrine that they go around, it was built directly underneath the pole star. And this, you know, it vouches for the Tawaf being an outgrowth of a collective movement of the stars, perishable stars, and this pole was envisioned as the center of heaven, as we talked, you know, we mentioned about the atom having a nucleus, right? And so they're going around the celestial imaginary pole, the stars go 7-9. So what was envisioned in the sky at night had become down on earth in human form, in human character, in human movement around the Kaaba, and the people are subliminally the stars on the ground. So is above, so is below, or so is below, so is above, right? And when you reimagine this, you know, it becomes the upper Kaaba, you know, which is circled around by the angelic beings, you know, in the celestial sky, in the celestial world. There's during the 10th century, some Muslims, where they saw the shrine as a temple, which they dedicated to what's referred to as the seven planetary stars, in their attempt to explain why the Tawaf was done seven so many times. So the seven stars are what? The sun and the moon and the five of the, you know, nine planets. Let's see if I can get them. Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Mercury. And there's always one that seems to slip my mind. But five of the planets in the sun and the moon. And so this is why you see on the Muslim flag or whatever, even in the Nation of Islam, for those who are familiar with that, where you see the crescent moon and the star. You know, based on an understanding of the, you know, the sun, moon, and the stars. And all the while, black people have been accused of star worship. African being been accused of star worship. It was referred to as the Islamic Brotherhood, right? That the so-called West has turned into terrorists, right? Such individuals as Bernard Lewis, this European who operated under their president, Jimmy Carter, named Zbigniew Brzezinski, Henry Kissinger, and some other shadowy killers who created what the people now refer to as a terrorist under the different names. You know, it started off with the Mujahideen. The Mujahideen was their buddies. The Mujahideen was only their buddies because the Mujahideen was made to believe that they could fight the Russian menace in the latter stages of the Cold War. You know, this invasion of Iran by the Russians, and that the Americans went there to help them in the liberation struggle, a guerrilla liberation struggle. And out of that came Osama bin Laden. There's even a picture of Brzezinski standing there with what became them holding the AK-47. And now all of a sudden, they're terrorists. You know, but they have this thing, this story that they kick around about seven people traveling at different speeds around a circular shape, a circular shaped city. You know, this is ready for this. This is a recollection of the seven times that the Israelites had to circle around Jericho to make his walls do what? Come tumbling down. And they went around the walls of Jericho seven times. So it's everywhere. There's a another place which is said to be Iran's second most populous city. In Central Asia's Turkmenistan region, you know, a second, you know, Mecca for Muslims. The mosque was circumambulated in the same fashion. They have their, you know, there are certain persons who have passed away, died, you know, like Christians have their saints and whatnot. This is like in the 19th century. City of Abdul Rahim al-Qanawi, you know, who died at the end of the 12th century, you know, in his mosque. And it's many, many thousands of people of the country were assembled on the plane. Person, as he arrived, walked seven times around the small mosque, which contains the tomb. And when the new covering intended to be laid over it for that year was brought in solemn procession, the whole assembly followed it seven times around the building, after which it was placed upon the tomb. So these are rituals
that been copied from the same people that the Muslims, the Christians, and the so-called Jews have been labeling as pagan, as idolatrous, as polytheists for a number of decades. But they've copied the rituals of the same people that they've been degrading in mass media. How can that be? How could that be? You know, it's incredible. You know, so, these are some examples in the Islamic realm. Now, called the Dome of the Rock, right? This is in the vicinity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque at Jerusalem. It's a monument built on the principle of circumambulation, competing with the seven times around the Kaaba. And this rock was said to have been the object on which Muhammad placed his foot when he ascended to the heavenly realm. Now, another thing that the in the Hindu wedding, you know, a couple gets married. What they do is, in one sense, they tie some type of thread around each of the male and the female's wrist, and they go around. One instance, if I can remember. They look up to the sky at night and perform this ritual. And they have to find the pole star and perform this ritual where they go around in the circle seven times. No. There's so much. You know, but in ancient Kemet, they would take I believe it was a statue, and they would make the seven perambulations with this statue. And the statue represented a symbol, one of the aspects of God. And so this was copied, you know, from Kemet, from the black people of Kemet. You know, story that projects this Muslim figure named Abu Yazid al-Bastami, you know, as the centerpiece in what was experienced as an ecstatic moment where he was circumambulated by the Kaaba coming to Medina. Now, it reverses the story around. It reverses the story around. He goes around him instead. You know, on another occasion, he was once encountered by a man on the pilgrimage to Arabia and had been cajoled into giving him a lump sum of money in exchange for going around the stranger seven times as a substitute. So here, he was so instrumental in the psychology of certain factions of Muslim in Islamic belief that you would make these circumambulations around him. You know. I mentioned the book of Judges, that if you count his position, you'll see that is the seventh book in the Bible. And the seven judges, the seven councils and whatnot, the earliest form, and then the hieroglyphic inscriptions, you know, in the judgment scene, you know, where they give this group who played a role of a council of judges or magistrates, leveling verdicts in favor of the righteous and against the wicked, you know, condemned the damned, we refer to as the failed souls, right? And one of these brilliant stories, it has the recording of a conversation of a man with his heart. And here, you know, the deceased is calling on his heart to not stand against him when he goes before these judges. And so, you know, there would, these rituals, these beliefs, they were the mummification process and the removal of certain body, the organs. The heart was believed to be placed in the vase. placed on one of the two pans of a scale. And on the other side was a feather. During his trial, his judgment, it had to maintain the balance. And all of this time, you know, we've been saying here in America, you know, you wake up, you feel good, you know, and maybe you just got a promotion, whatnot, right? Now you can start bossing some motherfuckers around and shit yourself. You know, you wake up, I feel light as a feather, you know. Or you spied and went out there and wronged somebody and can't sleep, tossing and turning, and they wake up. You know, then they talk about their heart is heavy, or they done lost a loved one, or somebody who influenced them in their lives, you know, and their heart is heavy. And all this time, this image had been the center where this had come from. When your heart is heavy, that means it outweighed the scale, it outweighed the feather. That meant your ass was no good. Our minister, we was talking, and he said something that he, I guess he recollects somebody told him about, you know, there's three things on your tombstone, about, you know, the time you was born, and the dash, and the time you close your eyes for the final time, right? And that it was that dash that mattered, right? It was the dash. And so when you standing there and your heart, it don't move in the vase, and it stays balanced with the feather. And that means you had lived a good life on earth, that you was an upstanding person, that you was a decent person, you know. And so the translation, of course, it says, stand not against me when speaking to bear witness. Repel not from me at the council of divine judges. Make not your rebellion against me in front of keeper of scales. The keeper of the scales was the one who oversaw the weighing of the hearts, you know, in the chamber hall of the judgment. You know, they got around to these divine beings. You know, it said these divine beings had a relationship with these figures in the sky. And it speaks of them being seven. And there's these chambers that the deceased had to go through, this whole grueling process. In one instance is the encounter 21 pylons. 21 pylons. And of course 3 times 7 is 21. or these seven chambers that the deceased had to go through in order to pass. And for those of us who are familiar with the Wu-Tang Clan, have heard them speak about the 36 chambers. And, of course, the 36 chambers, 12, 9, 18, 27, 36, order number 9. That's the, what we say is the solar understanding of it. Right? But these seven judges, they had a relationship with the little right? Who could have been related to the seven stars of the little dip. And the little dipper also was seen to circle around this center point of heaven. And so they say to the deceased, who presents his case, I have come. I have given an African an offer to what the Greeks call Osiris, my divine father. All his enemies I have overthrown, speaking truthfully on each day I have come. Meaning he has arrived. In another instance, it says the deceased says, I give judgment in company with the seven cobras, which become the reptilian counterpart of the seven councils. And it's a deep psychology. It's a deep psychology. In another inscription, the speaker goes on about the deceased's soul, faced with being proven through a series of seven trials. Or he repeats the same scenario over and over again, reaching a stanza of seven scriptural-like verses. And each time, a council of seven divine judges is left to do the presiding. And they say, our ancestors were primitive. Now, there's another group composed of seven. Right? Now, they symbolize the cardinal points, north, south, east, and west. There's another older square, and it's 40 individuals who are at the back of what they call the hinder part of the Great Bear, which is the foreleg. Some say that is the thigh, right? And it is said that this symbol is in the northern boundaries, the northern heavens boundary. So our ancestors had taken the sky and split it up the half, that you went to one phase first, where you got initiated in order to be allowed into what I say the Greeks copied as the Elysian fields. And then you have what we as the previous political party, reference as the seven laws or principles of Maya. And it is from Maya that everybody else created their religions. Everybody else created the fabric, the foundation of their religion. And so our ancestors, the Kemet, they had turned them into stories, into metaphors and stuff. Maya was a feminine name, who personified justice and law, the things that had to do with law, right? Now, there's a Christian illustration of this. She is the central figure in the Christian illustration in which a woman has got the better of the devil. And in sawing off his infernal majesty's right ear, as carved in the Church of St. Spire at the Corbeville community of Ontario, Canada. Now, this is something that had, you know, evolved in Africa and has made its way into a church that exists in Ontario, Canada. Now, in one of the creation stories, there were several of them. Just as sure as, you know, the creation story that we know in Genesis, right? Yeah, our ancestors in Kemet recorded several of them. But our children will never notice in the so-called West schools. This will never be taught in theology class, you know, throughout the country. You know, that the church, you know, orchestrates. You know, some go to theology school, but you won't get it there. The creation story at a temple in a place called Waset. This is in southern Kemet. And there's a passage that says they exist in the breast of Maya, seven divine ones with Ray in the northern heaven. In the breast of Maya, they're called divine beings with Ray. Ray is a symbol of the sun, a sublime message or language for the sun. Now, it may be problematic or astonishing for some to believe that the Bible actually says that God is the sun. And you won't get this in, you know, maybe the standard Bible class, you know, or at least I wouldn't bet on it. And they say that the people in ancient Egypt worshiped the sun. I said Egypt on purpose. The same symbolic meaning, of course, you know, it would become, you know, defensive, you know, on the part of those, you know, who see the Bible as their bedrock. So wait a minute, God ain't no sun, you know. But it's all right for them to say that, yeah, in Kemet, God is a sun. When you have the same scripture, the same meaning in the ancient Kemetic hieroglyphic inscriptions in the Bible. Now, what did the writer mean, though, is the question. What did he mean? What is the sun? What does the sun do? What does the sun do? If the sun went away, what would happen? If the sun just disappeared tomorrow, what would happen? If we woke up in the morning, for those of us who are in the dark right now, in this part of the world, and we woke up in the morning, there was no sun. What do you think would happen? What does the sun do? No. Do you think that they find out what energy is? How do they have the word ratio in science if the sun didn't mean anything? How could they have a radio if they didn't know what any of that stuff stood for? Radio waves. How could they know that? So the sun is a symbol of the power of God. This is why they use it as a symbol in Kemet. This is why they build monuments and temples and stuff in certain part of the day when the sun would move or appeared to be moving, that a ray would shine through a particular window, tunnel, and touch a certain point inside the temple and whatnot. They were that precise in knowing what they was doing. And the Catholic Church, the Masons who were building their cathedrals, maybe the past 1,500 years, have been copying that same science. Copying it all over the place. You can see it even in what they call Renaissance art, or so-called medieval age art. Everybody copied and imitated. Everybody. Another name for these divine beings gives the expression for the name. You know, his name defines them, in other words. And the word is means lawmakers, makers of the law, those who personify the seven laws. Yeah. And he had another rendition of themselves. And there's been these movies, these gruesome movies that have been made. There's a movie that was made, I believe, in the 80s called Hellraiser. And it's funny how the movie started over a cube. You know, they'd always put these subliminal messages when the movie started to show you that, oh, Egypt. Oh, look. You know, they start off in some place that look like it's the desert or some shit or whatever, rocks or some old place that he's digging up something, right? This is where they get the Rubik's Cube from. Pandora's Box. And that these Hellraisers would visit as the Grim Reapers. And so the leader's name was Pinhead because he had all these pins stuck in his head. You know, and they would come and be the ones who would ensnare their victims with hooks and pull their flesh apart in this movie. And these were the ones who were the condemners, or the ones who took over after those who were condemned to hell. And they took over, and they were the ones who were the torturers. And they called it the torture chamber. And there's another term that escapes me right now. Purgatory. All of major religions believe in purgatory. So where'd they get it from? How do you get around to it? You can see all this in the paintings, displays, drawings, and artwork at Kennett. There's an old story about a picture tells a thousand words of where that saying came from. So one of the ways to avoid these seven grim reapers from getting a hold of you was to sort of pray or use these enchantments, you know, these words of power. And everybody does it. When a hurricane comes to threaten the West, and those who are Christians, Catholic Christians, what do? They get on their knees and they recite the Hail Mary. Shit. They even do that in football. Last play of the game, and the cameraman is panning the people in the stadium. What do you see them sitting there doing? Got their fingers crossed. Some got their hands clasped together like they about to pray. And so the quarterback goes back and throws a last pass. He just throws the shit up because he ain't got nothing to lose. But lo and behold, what happened? A miracle. And the team won the game on the last play of the game. And they call that what? What they call that pass? a Hail Mary. Now, they got this little dude not playing for Arizona. His last name is Murray. So he did this shit, I think, a couple of times year before last, or last year. And some genius come up with a new slogan. He replaced Mary with Murray and called it the Hail Mary. Well, the same belief, the same psychology, is an inscription. If he knew each one of them names, which he had to know, he had to have knowledge of them in order to get into the heavenly realm. The deceased, he would say something like, I know, your names I know, your names I know, as well as mine you know. To you I come, come you to me. I through you live, you through me live. And so this is a communication that he's doing. This psychology that they had developed, you know, in real life version, you know, they had the seven counselors, you know, and they would wait, you know, in ancient comedic society, you know, they would oversee, you know, they were commissioners, you know, like you have today, you know, commissioners and whatnot, you know, those who administer decrees, you know, the seven officials who worked in the house of government. And from all of that, you see how these parliaments have been set up, you know, how these constitutions have been set up, right? Now, another way they was able to tell or to display what they were saying. This name, something like the Shezu, right? It meant seven knots. You know, these seven knots. And if you look in one of the paintings of the judgment scene, you see this beam that's holding up the scales of justice, right? This vertical beam that holds up the scales of justice. And along this beam, there's these seven knots, they look like dots in one of the ancient comedic painting scenes. Right? And each one of these represent a level to this scale. At the very top of the beam, or right above the crossbar that holds each, you know, the pan, you know, pan on the left, pan on the right, is the head of a jackal, right? And right below that is another knot. Now, when you look at this scene, the average Joe and Joanne, you know, couldn't make nothing of it. But for some reason, something would at least register that, okay, what is these seven things? Okay, there's one, two, somebody would at least figure, okay, well, there's these seven, like, little things on this thing, and there's the head of this jacket. And so, well, I know that this is a scale because I see that when I went to court, you know, for robbery, right? So, you know, you can get somewhere. But the amazing part about the whole thing was that they got this from the sky. That's the incredible part about it. The beam is a symbol of the celestial, imaginary celestial, the pole, right? The tip is occupied by the pole star, right? Marked by the eight knots. And this pole star was one by itself, and then the other stars of the Dipper. And that's how they got to it. And you want to talk about this is civilization. So this jackal had been the symbol in ancient Kemet of the pole star. And so that's why you see that jackal's head at the top of that beam. And, of course, what the jackal represented in ancient Kemet. Other societies, other religions, other groups and tribes, whatnot, may have a wolf, a dog. Some may have a jaguar. Right? Which is the same symbolic gesture of the particular type of animal. And as I say, these animals were the first symbolic representations out of nature and what they meant and what they stood for. And this is how deep our people were thousands of years ago, and that from that, the other religions created theirs. Now, just ahead of the deceased claiming to know their names, these seven figures again, the Zesu, turns to them. No, I mean, not turns to them, but they've been converted into the executioners, the tormentors, the heart, they're called heart snatchers, decapitators, who hack into pieces the condemned, a punishment hoped to be avoided in the notorious island of fire. Whoa. Doesn't that sound familiar? Burning hell. Burning in hell. Yeah, the burning hell. The seven executioners. It's amazing, isn't it? In the tomb of one of the kings, one of the black kings, whose name was Ramoses, and the word Moses, the African term. He was the third Ramoses, this king. All right. You can see this imagery, you know. You see these beautiful paintings of it. The condemned are shown with their arms tied to a seven-headed jackal stakes. The seven, wait, let me say that right. You see that the condemned, their arms tied to seven jackal-headed stakes. They are awaiting punishment. And they are guarded by others who spare them no pain as the torturers. And check this out. And it is in the seventh hour that the whole phase of judgment takes place, according to these inscriptions that complement the pain, like the sun's passage through the seven, through its gates, which is 12. Now, you come across the same thing in the Quran. And they said our ancestors were paid. So let's turn to the 14th verse of the 7th chapter of the book of Ezra, where we encounter the following, which was supposedly told to the author by the Persian ruler known as Artaxerxes, who lived over 2,400 years ago. He was a real king, Persian king. For as much as thou art sent of the king and of his what? Seven counselors to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem according to what? The law of thy God which is in thine hand. Artaxerxes, by the way, of seven students of the law, had given Ezra the seal of approval to oversee the so-called religious and civil affairs in the Palestinian territory that had been converted into Israel and taken over by the Persian king. And did it happen out of the blue? And it didn't happen out of the blue that the seventh book of the Old Testament was slated to be called Judges. And check this out, that the first verse of the sixth chapter tells us what? The children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the land, into the hand of Midian 7 years. He delivered them into the hand of Midian 7 years because of the evil they had been doing. And that is nothing but a version of being turned over to the seven executions. Here, Midian is seen as the executioners in 7 years. Read another. Let's see. The 19th chapter of Psalms, verse 163. The author, believed to be King David, states, I hate and abhor lying, but thy law do I love. Seven times a day do I praise thee because of thy righteous judgments. Do y'all believe that's a coincidence? Great peace have they which love thy law, and nothing shall offend them. In the 16th verse of the 24th chapter of Proverbs, it is said, for a just man falleth seven times and riseth up again, but the wicked shall fall into mischief. Is that coincidence? If you look the episodes from Genesis, from Jeremiah, right, selectively choosing carefully the leaders of what I call the Hebraists, concluded that the Almighty Creator had given Noah seven laws, of which the last was to refrain from eating the limb of an animal while it was still alive. It was when Moses came along, three more were added, which gave birth to the famed Ten Commandments. Now I'm going to go a little more. And we may wonder whether or not could that animal's limb have been a bull's or an ox's foreleg, as in the ancient Kemetic sign for the seven stars of the Great Dipper, the asterism in the Great Bear. The Freemasons recognized the Noachian seven laws in their 21st degree called the Noachite or Prussian Knight, which was established in the East European country of Germany. How's that? The Noachian seven laws, 21st degree. The 21st degree is no more or less than the 21 pylons that the deceased had to come to and encounter at each one. And that they had seven counselors that he had to stand before, judges, and that if his ass sailed, he had to deal with seven torturers. And so you see how the Masons have continued that ancient Kemetic psychology, and it lies hidden in there. How about we go to what they call the Watchers? Let's see. Quite reminiscent of the biblical watchers who issued the decree of chastisement against Nebuchadnezzar, right? Where the king's city is said to be tormented according to the first few verses of Isaiah chapter 30. In preparing those whose job it is, the Almighty Creator, after scooping out things from a lofty vantage point, scoping them out, right, is made to say, I have commanded my sanctified ones. I have also called my mighty ones for mine anger, even them that rejoice in my highness, the Lord of hosts. There's that name. There's that name. I can't make this up. The Lord of hosts. Let's put that in the layman's terms. Basically, the God of the stars is what it's saying here. Mustered the host of the battle. As I said in the beginning, that there's the white ruling class and their little flunkies, black, brown, red, and yellow, will give the masses one Bible and they'll keep the other one for themselves. They practice esotericism and give the masses exotericism, which is why they're always looking at things in the concrete and taking everything literally. Like Dr. Martin Luther King said, capitalism to the poor and socialism for the rich. As the scripture continues, they come from a far country, from the end of heaven, even the Lord, and the weapons of his indignation to destroy the whole land. I just, you know, tried to give an example of the esoteric understanding of the scripture. He sort of toys with you in the sense, you know, but not meant to be in a bad way. It's meant to heighten your consciousness. It's meant for you to figure out this riddle, in a sense. I have commanded my sanctified ones. I have also called my mighty ones for mine anger, even them that rejoice in my highness. The Lord of the stars mustered the host of the battle. They come from a far country, from the end of heaven. You get it? Even the Lord and the weapons of his indignation to destroy the whole land. So we go four books forward where we enter Daniel, right? Who's, you know, hailing from the farthest part of the upper world. He dreams of four beasts, of which the second guarantees Babylon's destruction, as lodged in what? The seventh chapter. Now listen to this. Listen to this. And behold, another beast, a second, like a bear. And it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, arise, devour much flesh. In plain language, the author, an expert in astronomical mythosymbology, enters the stars of the great bears of the Almighty Creator's host, which will serve justice. And this may be quite incredibly hard for some to believe, and it's all right. And so the seven stars being the brightest among the stars in the nighttime sky had taken on this huge psychological position. And so some of you may have heard, you know, people speak, you know, they say the Bible is written in symbols and whatnot. And it's amazing, right? Here's the veiled meaning behind the saints. I have also called my mighty ones for mine anger, even them that rejoice in my highness. That is, in the psychological realm's farthest point at the circumpolar region, which when viewed vertically. This is why he says they have come from a far country, from the end of heaven. Where is that? Where is this far country from the end of heaven? Where is it? What this ideology of this seven council of judges, this council of seven judges, right, is also expressing what they call post-biblical writings. You know, the so-called Jewish, you know, people are supposed to be in possession of these post-biblical writings and stuff, right? A judicial procedure involving a certain number of magistrates needed to reach a verdict was described by Rabban Ben Gamaliel or something like that, Gamaliel, who was a member of what was called the Sanhedrin or Assembly Council. They're doing what they like to say, the second century. Now, there's this sort of riddle that's spoken of in what they this writing is called the Mishnah, M-I-S-H-N-A-H, right? And this is what it says. With three do they begin. With five more, they debate the matter, and they reach a final decision with seven more judges. Now, in Masonic circles, it's what's called 357. In the streets, it's a 357. Could there be a correlation there? Now, you can read this two ways if you want to. You'd have to add up the numbers. But this is what they say. With three do they begin. With five, which is more than three, they debate the matter. They reach a final decision with seven, which is more than five, meaning the seven judges. Now, the average Joe and Joanne would add up all these numbers, you know, five more and then seven more, right? You got three. Then you got five more, which is eight. And then you got seven more, which is 15. That's in another realm, because the number 15 also is symbolic. But here's these riddles that they wrote. Now, this Rabbi Judah stated the council interrogated the witnesses with seven points of interrogation. In what septenic, as I said, there's the word sept, which is Latin and the Greek hep for the number seven, which is why it's called September, because originally the year began in spring. March, April, May, June, July, August, September. March, April, May, June, July, August, September, number seven. In what year, in what month, on what day of the month, on what day of the week, at what time, in what place? Now, there are seven points of interrogation. In what septennit, in what year, in what month, on what day of the month, on what day of the week, at what time, and in what place. That's seven times. That's a total of seven. You see the symbolism? All copied from Africa. Some Rabbi Simeon, the contemporary of Gamaliel, I'll get that name right one of these days, remarked that the court instituted seven measures which pertain to the finances and the trusted hands of those who ran the place of worship. Seven measures. When it was asked among the rabbis what constituted a bloodthirsty court, the first reply was that a man who practiced magic be executed or given the death penalty once in 7 years. Now, that is amazing how they say you will practice magic and be executed. But in Kabbalism, what they do, Kabbalistical magic. Said that Jesus fed the multitude 7 loaves of bread, I believe. Which was a magical thing. Now, those who've been to Catholic school or raised in the Catholic church and went to mass and whatnot, who read the catechism and other books produced by Catholicism, they have a decree on the part of the Catholic Church at the Council of Florence in Italy during the 15th century, right? Where Christians must adhere to 7 sacraments of the new law, namely baptism, confirmation, the Eucharist, penance, extreme unction, order, and matrimony. Claimed to have been instituted by Jesus, a divine institution, according to the oft-quoted Thomas Aquinas. But in the Middle Ages, there were writers who had remembered that it was during the 12th century that either of the 2 bishops, Otto of Bamberg or Peter Lombard, who had been the first biblical scholar to gather up the sacraments as 7 in number. Regardless. Now, the old law supplanted planters of the old law. These 7, they are personified by Jesus. Wherefore, Matthew's author makes him say the following in the 17th verse of chapter 5. Read, think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. The Hindus have the same thing. What they call the laws of Manu, M-A-U-N, M-A-N-U, right? These codes. You know, which is the highest type in, you know, which the highest type is, you know, proper conduct. Manu was said to have been schooled by the Almighty Creator, whose name is Brahma, which just like in the Kabbalists, what they call Ein Sof, is the unknown. The same thing, the same belief system. Right. He had these virtues of law that he had taught to these persons referred to as the 7 rishis. And the 7 rishis in their own books, they admit is the human personification of the 7 stars of the Big Dipper. And here it is right here in the court system. Manu wrote that the king should appoint 7 or 8 counselors who were natives of India, well-learned in law. They were brave. They had to be brave, successful, from noble families, and they were investigated across the board. Those were the requirements. And so on and so on and so on. And they talk about how they sprung and how they came into an existence. Right? Now, I want to make sure I get to the last part here. And you know, there's these legends about King Arthur. You know, I know when I was a boy about King Arthur, and they made these movies and whatnot, and the Knights of the Round Table. And these Knights of the Round Table originally were 7. And it is said that they wore these shining, shining, you know, protective gear, you know. And they said that they shine like the stars. And the name Arthur just so happened to mean something related to the word for bear. Isn't that something? And here in the scriptures, in the Bible, in the book of Job, in the book of Job, canst thou guide Arcturus with his sons? This is a scripture, the book of Job. This is symbolic language. Symbolic language. In the fifth chapter of Job, the third verse, this is what it says. His substance was also 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, and 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 she-asses. So that this man was the greatest of all the men in the East. Sort of like a shepherd. And Osiris is seen as a herdsman who, in one instance, said they have been the founder of what we call agriculture today. And he had been fused with another Godhead type named Hap or Hep, who had a bull as a symbolic creation, a symbol of creation, the power of the bull. And I mentioned that. So you fuse them together, and you have what the Greeks stole as Serapis, some like to pronounce it Serapis. And it gets deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. The Chinese even had it. When they talk about the stars, the Chinese got all types of rituals that they dedicate to the seven stars of the Great Bear. All types of rituals. They have rituals based on medicine and healing because they believe that these seven powers were powerful enough to heal those who were sick. And of course, they had their own concoctions that they would make and drink to heal themselves. And they've known about this for several thousands of years. The deepest, the heaviest part of the Bible is the book of Revelation. It has some of the greatest examples of the type of knowledge that our ancestors had gained to come around to. Chapter 1, verse 4. John to the seven churches which are in Asia. Grace be unto you, and peace from him which is, which was, and which is to come. Verse 11 gives the names of these churches. Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamos, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea, the names of the seven churches. In Kemet, they had seven temples. Seven temples. The Catholic Church, 9th century Italian dictionaries, enters a record of the seven churches of Rome, capital of Christian. And these seven temples were built by Ramses II up and down the Nile, symbolically, strategically placed. If you go to the state of Krakow in East Europe, the country of Poland, you know, white Jewish people that have what's called seven synagogues. They are historical landmarks. You know, the Hindus have seven temples. When these Buddhists, they have seven sacred temples. You know. They've all copied. You know, the Muslims have seven sacred mosques. Mm-hmm. Towards the end of the fourth verse of the first chapter, what does Revelation say? Speaks of the peace that will come from the seven spirits, which are before the throne. In ancient Kemet, our ancestors also believed in seven spirits. Thousands of years before any of these religions were called or named or before their founders. And these seven spirits in ancient Kemet are said to be correlations of the seven stars of the Big Dipper and the celestial throne. The celestial throne in the center of heaven is the equivalent of the celestial star. And this may be startling to some. And it gave off the appearance of the seven spirits which are before the throne. And here's an inscription where it speaks about them, where they assign these roles to the seven spirits in Kemet. The white man likes to call these inscriptions that were found, you know, etched inside the lids of the coffins, and on the outside, and scrolls and everything. So the soul who is blessed because it seeks passage to the afterlife says this of the seven spirit beings, these ferry boat men who belong to the sky. Now they ferry him across. Here's another where he speaks about, you know, those who love justice acts by the blessed to relieve him of all evil or wicked sins, fighting what the council did for the seven noble spirits counted among followers of Sipa, their lord, who was no more than an Osiris. What the Greeks referred to as Osiris. And here you see in the verse 3 through 6 of Ephesians, the chapter 4, Ephesians verses 3 through 6, speaks of the unity of the Spirit, as though it was composed of a collective of things of which the author says, there is one body and one spirit, even as ye are called in one hope of your calling, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all. Right in there. I can't make this up. In one instance, they're called the seven guardians. This is where Hollywood stole the Chinese belief system of the seven samurai and created their movie. And the new one that Denzel Washington is in. You know, which has been passed down. Then there's the seven seers, the seven watchers. The seven spirits are seen now as seers in the darkness, watchers by night. In the book called the Zohar, claimed as sapphire, radiance, brightness, merit, flashing, lightning, scarlet thread, and the ultimate, the supreme, and so on and so on. Verse 12, chapter 1, Revelation. The author says, I turned to see the voice that spake to me, and being turned, I saw seven golden candlesticks. Jesus, whom the next verse enunciates, and in the midst of the seven candlesticks, one like unto the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the foot and girt about the paps, with a golden girdle, his head and his hair were white like wool, and his eyes were as a flame of fire, and his feet like unto fine brass, as they were burned in the furnace. And this is where black people point to the Bible and say that Jesus couldn't have possibly have been white if he had feet as if they were burned in the furnace, brass as if it was burned in the furnace. You know, the white Jewish we have what's called the seven-armed menorah, you know, in Kwanzaa, you know, African people, you know, they have the seven candlesticks. And the Bible speaks of it, you know, describing verses 31, 32, the 25th chapter of Exodus, as a candlestick of pure gold with six branches protruding out of the sides of it, three branches of the candlestick out of the side, one side, three branches of the candlestick out of the other side. Josephus, who is known in theological circles, famous, said to have lived in the second century and who was a follower of the faith, gave a miraculous account of the candles holder of its evolution, by which means the shaft elevated itself on high from a single base and spread itself into as many branches as there are planets, including the sun among them. It terminated in seven heads in one row, all standing parallel to one another. The miraculous creation of this thing. But he said that the seven candlesticks astronomical organ were derived not from the Big Dipper seven stars, but from the seven planets, or Sun, Moon, Mars, Mercury, I put Thursday, Venus, and Saturn, and of course the days of the week. Yeah. Then the 16th verse chapter. And he had in his right hand seven stars, and his countenance was as the sun, shineth in his strength. In the 12th verse, they appeared with what was gotten out of them, the mystery of the seven stars, which thou saw in my right hand, and the seven golden candlesticks. The seven stars are the seven angels of the seven churches, and the seven candlesticks, which thou saw, are the seven churches. They explain to you what it is. Verse 1, chapter 2, unto the angel of the church of Ephesus write, these things said he that held the seven stars in his right hand. And unto the angel of the church, the third chapter, first verse, of Sardis write, these things said he that had the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. Right then. And you can see all these things in the ancient comedic system. And so they copied everything. Yet our ancestors have been labeled anything but the children of God, pagan and everything else. 37th verse of the 25th chapter of Exodus going back. And thou shalt make the seven lamps thereof, and they shall light the lamps thereof, that they may give light over against it. In the second verse of the 8th chapter of Numbers, speaking unto Aaron and saying to him, when thou lightest the lamps, seven lamps shall give light over against the candlestick. And it just goes deeper and deeper and deeper. You know, but I just wanted to give some examples of the type of knowledge that our ancestors accumulated, that have been passed down, that have been copied through the so-called Middle Ages into present time, in philosophy class and theology class and in art symbolism and architecture around the world. Around the world. This type of knowledge that kept civilization together once it was established and built. And so this is the age of darkness. And there will be casualties. And it's the people that had to take their lives back to their own hands.
So we enjoy doing this. We always enjoy doing, you know, these broadcasts for our people, In Defense of the People Radio, brought to you by People's Political Party. I'm one of your hosts, Chairman Nat, and my co-host, our Minister of Defense for the Motherland, and our assault technician on the ones and twos, Sister Amado, showing our Minister of Communication. And we see all power to the people, black power to black people specifically. The whole rule, and we'll be back. Or like Dr. Cosby say, black in a minute, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern. Stay tuned. Next week, we out.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know